want to address in this talk, my title is, and somebody's telling you how the universe started, and then space emerged, or space-time emerged, and then blah, 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 there were quantum fields, and there were, and I want to understand what you mean when you say that, because I want to understand what I mean when I say that. Okay. So that's the subtle, that's the one title that this can have. I want to say that there are a number of philosophers that have had deep, lasting influence on me. And so I want to say that I deeply approve of the purpose of this conference, which if you go, if we can ever get it on the screen. Let me just remind you of the spirit, the first days of the meeting, in which you were talking about forming a great community of diverse participants to go after this problem, quantum gravity, from a multi-dimensional perspective. And I approve of that. And I think you all should be doing it. Yeah. And I would like to be doing it as well. So I approve of the goals, and I hope I can contribute something small to those goals. I have had a lot of experience with philosophers of various kinds, and I wouldn't be anything like the, I wouldn't be myself if I had not had strong influence from those philosophers. And but that's not what I really want to talk to you about. What I really want to talk to you about is a few of us have come up with an idea that we like. Oh, that's good. Okay, so those are the philosophers that have had a deep influence on me and some of the things I learned from them. To be a relationalist, which I learned from Julian Barber at the family hearth, so to speak. To be a realist, which I think I learned from Roberto Mangibera-Era and Drusilla Cornell. To take seriously the idea that quantum mechanics is dead and dying, which I learned from everybody that I think just was honest with me, but maybe that's too provocative. And what I'd like to do is tell you about a research program which is underway. There are just a few of us working on it. It's related to the causal set program that Faye and others talked about, but it's very different. It's called energetic causal sets. And what I'd like to do is show you some of the results in energetic causal sets and explain, and then use that to come back to the question about how space emerges. However, I'm going to take a detour, because I love detours. And in my detour, I'm going to talk about the BFSS model, because Robert introduced it. And it turns out that I studied the BFS model as an example of a hidden variable theory. So I'm going to start with hidden variable theories and the BFSS model, and then we'll go from there. So it's going to, we're taking a swerve towards BFSS. And BFSS, what you really need to know about it is that the degrees of freedom are matrices. There are some number D, A equals 1 to D, and there are D matrices, and they're very big. They're N by N, and in all of our considerations, N is going to be going to infinity. And of course, what do they know about that? Well, that's another question. I'm not going to be rigorous, but there are issues about what it means to take matrix products to, with N goes to infinity. So, here's a simple argument that there should be hidden variable theories where the degrees of freedom are matrices. The idea of a hidden variable theory, I think, is a relational idea. It's an idea that for every pair of ordinary observables or degrees of freedom in the world, there's a degree of an additional degree of freedom. That's what I think, that's maybe an overkill, but that's certainly something like what Einstein and Born and et cetera were telling us. So I'm going to assume that you fill me with, you come to me with a classical variable, d dimensions, n versions of it, and I'm going to promote it to a matrix. Okay, will you let me do that? And that matrix, it's going to have symmetries. One of the symmetries are, do we have a talk? Oh, we have a talk.
We have a talk. I can advance it. So
just go back.
You want to try that? I think we're back.
Well, let me keep going here. We have a symmetry where we take the variable x, which stands for the matrix, xijA.
So here you go. This is working. You can just go
far by that. Oh, okay. Yeah. You promise this works? Which one do I take?
Forward and backward, yeah, good.
Okay. Another name for this theory I'm telling you about is the causal theory of views. And it'll become clear as I talk about it, what we're talking about. And the goal of the whole talk is to introduce a principle that we think comes from this, which I might as well just, since I'm all out of order, I'll just tell you right now. We're proposing a quantum Mach principle. And the idea of the quantum Mach principle is that you need something, if you're going to be having space or space-time, quote, emerge from a world where there is no space or space-time, you need something to guide it along so that the space comes out with the right properties hooked up to the degrees of freedom of particles and fields in the right way. And that's what this quantum Mach principle says. So we'll get there. Okay. So this new paradigm I'm talking about is to describe physics before space emerged. So the degrees of freedom, I don't know, we can do with it. Anyway, the degrees of freedom are now going to be matrices, and the action principle is going to look like a sum over the d number of matrices, the n by n matrices, and there's going to be terms like x dot squared, and there's going to be terms like commutator of xa, xb squared. Okay, so that's the theory I studied. It was invented by people studying supersymmetric Yang-Mills theory many years before. It was basically the authors, BFSS, essentially stole it from a literature where it already existed and said, if D is 11, this is going to be a model of M theory. And it lasted for a while and got a lot of attention. But I'm going to use it to demonstrate that there's a hidden variable theory in there. And the idea, and I think, okay, so I mentioned the idea of relational hidden variables. I'm very interested in non-locality. And my belief about non-locality in the world, and this is why somebody asked yesterday or the day before, why did we believe that space emerges? And I forgot to say this is the key reason, which is that if space emerges, then there's a world before space, and there's no locality. Because if there's no space, there's no locality. There's no non-locality. I just have degrees of freedom which interact with each other under simple rules. And the quantum non-locality, I conjecture, is what's left over after we make basically a phase transition to a system with less symmetry, which is the quantum field theory. So I have my degrees of freedom are matrices. The matrices have a diagonal subspace and an off-diagonal set of terms, and a function of those are the eigenvalues. There are n eigenvalues times d. And I'm going to show you, only I'm not, that if you consider the probability density rho for the eigenvalues, and you have something which is like a generalization of the Hamilton-Jacobi function, and you construct a complex function, psi of x, let's call it psi of x equals square root of rho e to the is, then you can show that if you heat all the off-diagonal elements up to a finite temperature, so you know their statistical distribution, and you carefully take the limit that t goes to zero as n goes to infinity, then you discover a quantum mechanical system with an infinite number of degrees of freedom. But it's a genuine quantum mechanical system. So that's the first place that I want to talk about. And in that quantum mechanical system, the eigenvalues are basically particles. They're positions of particles, of n particles in d-dimensional space. And they act like particles. That is, this is the Schrodinger equation for them. Okay. Can we now normalize? Any questions about that? Because I wanted to make that claim. I should say there are about half a dozen or more relational, non-local hidden variable theories that all use the same move of starting with matrices, taking the limits of the sizes of the matrix to infinity, tuning the environmental parameters, like the temperature, and getting out quantum mechanical theories or quantum field theories. So a number of people have worked on this, and I can give you the literature if you want. Okay. Here's some of a list of them. Okay. So now I want to talk about the causal set models. And this is a picture, roughly, of the kind of causal set model that Faye told you about yesterday. They're beautiful. I have a lot of admiration for what my friends there have done with them. But I think they're not the right kind of theory. And there are two reasons for that. One of them is that I want the events in a causal set to be things that really happen. Whereas the events in the points or the nodes in their kind of causal set models are just mathematical points which you assumed are going to go to pile up to infinity as you take a limit as n goes to infinity there. So I am not interested in taking any n to infinity limits. And rather like Cole Furry, who gave me a hard time for forgetting that she proposed this. If you don't know that story, you don't need to.
I think we do.
Well, then we'll do it in the break.
Okay.
It's a very interesting theory of disagreement coming from misunderstandings. But anyway, what she did is she said we should have causal set theories where the points or the events where things happen are things that really happen. That is, they involve matter. And they involve interactions and collisions of different kinds of matter. And the lines between events are real transmissions of energy and momentum. So the way that we build the causal set, there are nodes, which is where things happen. Our version of what that means in real language, in quantum mechanics, is that an event is a place where things that were indefinite become definite. So that's our working understanding of what an event is. And the events are connected by transmissions, which contain fixed amounts of energy and momentum. And that's the world. The world is events which take in energy and momentum from previous events and divide up and send it forward to other events. And that's all that happens in the world. But our world fundamentally has the causal time and the energy and momentum and no space and no space-time. Okay? So that's an energetic causal set. So our events are a little bit more complicated. We have a momentum Q. IL is the momentum that goes from event I to event L, etc. And we conserve energy and momentum at the interactions where things happen. So small PIJ is the energy going into the ith interval, the ith event from the jth event, etc. And we're going to make a, you asked me, how am I going to describe the dynamics of this? Well, it's easy. I mean, I'm a quantum field theorist. We write down constraints, and then we exponentiate them. So we now get to the very, this is very old-fashioned stuff, but something kind of neat happens. So we have conservation laws associated with each event, which are that the sum of momentum into the event is equal to the sum of the momentum energy out of the event. I ask that the energy coming out of an event is equal to the energy that that causes to go into an event. That seems like a nice thing to do, but I give myself the possibility of changing that, having a different energy go into the next event, because I believe in gravity and that's what happens in gravitational fields. But that's the last thing I'm going to say about gravity. And then I have the energy-momentum relations, p squared plus m squared is equal to zero, along each of the edges that p squared travels. Okay. So that's the theory. Notice that there's no space-time. There is a metric, which is the metric of momentum space. That is, I know how to say p squared, but there's no metric of space-time, and there's no placement of these events in any space-time.
So the
yes.
So the p and momenta and their vectors.
Yes.
They are
not
spatial vectors.
They're not.
Spatial vectors.
No, they're time-like or no.
Okay.
So we have a rule for probability. We add up. We're going to add up all the possible ways, given some incoming particles, for our processes to transform, etc., to outgoing particles. So we're being very conventional. This is the Feynman path over integrals. And we write down the sums over all the energy and momentum that go along those processes. And we multiply by the constraints. And that's the definition of the theory. And notice that there's no h-bar anywhere, and I really looked hard for it. You know? And there is no h-bar, and the reason why there's no h-bar is there's no position. There's no space-time coordinate, so there's no h-bar.
So what is AI there?
AI is, that's some other terms that might come into an interaction that if you stay for the advanced version of this talk, I'll explain.
But I thought h-bar would be inside AI.
You would have thought, yes.
Or do you think it's not
that? No, but there is material out there that you can hammer together and call it h-bar, if you so deserve. Okay, there's no commutation relations, there's no uncertainty principle. That's just a simple, it's just a simple sum and integral over momentum, little bits of momentum.
Capital pi's mean products?
Yes. So what I'm going to do next is I'm going to introduce Lagrange multipliers. And so now I have something over here. I have an action. And the action consists of Lagrange multipliers, like this Z. And this is a Z for every node, which multiplies the conservation law of energy and momentum there. So, and that's my action. By the way, general relativity has an action, which is just a sum of constraints. And we somehow think it's a good thing. It's very pure of us to have actions which are sums of constraints. Anyway, it's familiar territory for us. So we study it, and let me study first the classical theory, and then I'll say something about the quantum theory. And when I say the quantum theory, I don't mean the quantum theory. I mean a statistical ensemble of these processes. I should watch myself. So if I vary the action by the constraints, I get the energy and momentum is conserved. I get the energy in is energy out. I get the particles traveling satisfy the energy momentum relation. And I can choose to have masses or not. If I look at the equations of motion, I vary, for example, by a P, by a momentum, and I pick up a P goes from one node to another node, and I pick up a relation that involves the Lagrange multipliers of those nodes. And those equations look like the difference between the Lagrange multipliers is the momentum on that edge times a Lagrange multiplier. So what's happened? It looks like space has, quote, emerged. But let's look a little bit closer at what's happened. What you get is an equation like this for every pair of Lagrange multipliers. If that is, the question is, how many equations like that do you have? And can you solve them all to create a story of particles moving in Minkowski spacetime? If you can, then I would say that space has emerged. If, however, you have too many equations, or not the right equations, then you won't get a story in which there's anything going on in spacetime. But there will be still a story of things evolving. The world will go on, but it won't go on in space or time. So I want to claim this as a genuine example of space-time emerging. Anybody disagree with that?
Well, you haven't shown the space-time, so it's hard to...
Well, let me do this like this. Every time I have one of these relations, I'm going to draw a little piece of Minkowski space around it, because I can certainly do that. Let's call that a shard of Minkowski space. Then there's going to be another piece of Minkowski space that takes me down. I hope that the, maybe I'm ruining the blackboards. Does that cost a lot? And so on. I know I'm supposed to be more high-tech than that. Anyway, it's very easy to see just counting that if, depending on the number of degrees of freedom of momentum, if you have too many such equations, you're not going to be able to fulfill them while keeping the picture of particles embedded in Minkowski spacetime. So it's might be true and it might not be true. Which is, it seems to me that's part of what we mean by a genuine emergence, is that it might happen or it might not happen.
What's the distinction between the P's and the Q's?
The distinction between the P's and the Q's, they wanted to have the Q's coming out to the future and the P's looking back, because I want to have the possibility of having redshifts.
So they're all momenta, it's just one's past, one's
future.
Past, Q's are future, is that?
Yes,
it?
Yes.
And why you're the, that distinction? Why not?
Oh, do I get to answer that question?
Yeah.
Are you sure?
Sure.
Okay, so what I believe about this universe is that it's what we call a presentist universe. There are three kinds of things that might be there. There are things that just happened. That is an event just formed out of previous events. And let's call that an event in the now. There are events in the past. Oh, an important rule that I have some rule that tells me how to build these things into the future. And I can tell you there's a bunch of different rules we try. But they all have the property, which the regular causal set people don't have, that you can make one out, you can, a node can be a parent of only a certain number of future nodes. And that means that after a node is saturated and it has communicated the information it has to a finite number of future nodes, it might as well be dead. It's not going to influence the future at all. So we're just going to say that that's the past, and it has no effect on the world, so we're just going to say the past doesn't exist. The future doesn't exist either, because the future we only can make probabilistic inferences about. So the world consists, and it's a cute exercise to work these things out, but then I begin to believe this. The world exists in a bunch of events where what is not determined becomes determined and then goes on, then goes on. And the world is only two or three events back old. That is, where the world only has a present which is thick. A thick present is one when which two events can be in the same present and can be causally related. So it's a bit thick, but it's not that thick. So there's sort of nothing behind us, if you understand what I'm trying to say. And I think that that's very cool. So that makes the future and the past and all that essential to how I think about this. So let me tell you what we've done with this. We have made computer models, and we here is Marina Cortez mostly, and some students of hers who are also making models. And we have studied these models in two, and some in three and four dimensions. And we've discovered that they have a very interesting property. They go through a phase transition. The models start out moving forward, but very messily and very chaotically. And as they go into the future, they find limit cycles. As they begin to lose the number of degrees of freedom and end up with particles in limit cycles, which means that you're kind of can go backwards. Now, you can't really go backwards if you're in a limit cycle, but you can locally, as far as you can tell, you can go backwards. So the world goes from, this model world goes from a very time irreversible phase to a phase which is sort of a fake reversible phase. And we've been studying those. We also discovered that there's a lot of, there are different notions of the future. There's in this kind of model, and they don't always agree. So there are some phenomena that some people would call, Steve, help me. These are models where there's two versions of time, and some go backwards with respect. Retrocausal. Right. So these models have retrocausality in them, and we think that's related to why they have quantum mechanics in them. We've studied quantum field theories. That's my last paper, in which we have cut off versions of quantum field theories, and we think that we're describing them in a way, basically in the language of amplitudes, that many people have discovered. And we have a program which hasn't gotten very far. But Ted, we're trying to use Ted's kinds of ideas and strategies to derive general relativity. But we haven't succeeded. Okay, so I think I can stop there. Yes.
So I understand the picture you want and that you say. But once you exponentiate it, let's just take the z's and the p's. You've got an integral over dz dp of e to the something zp.
Yes.
And you say if you integrate over z, you're going to get delta of p. But I could just as easily integrate over the p's and get delta of z. So doesn't that put space and spatial things and momentum things effectively on the same footing?
I mean, you
could integrate over z's to get delta of p, but I could just as well integrate over p's to get deltas of z's. I don't know what it would mean, but...
Well, I'm not sure that just as well is true, because these things are very imperfect. We don't integrate momentum from minus infinity to infinity. For example, there's stories that I haven't told. We want to have finite and different. My intuition, which is very different, it seems, than most people's, is that there's no symmetry essentially in the world. The world is messy. There are some mathematically beautiful things that happen, but they sort of happen coincidentally and go on. And I don't believe in, well, I don't believe in running momentum all the way up to infinity. So when I say there's a momentum space, for me it's always a finite space. And I live with the messiness that that implies.
Well, the action is linear in Z and P. Forget about the other clutter for a minute. Just the action, Z and P, and you've got an integral over Z and an integral over P. If I integrate over Z, I get delta of P. But if I integrate over P, I get delta of Z.
No, but Rob, you can't integrate.
Unless there's something else there that
The integral over P is messy and unpredictable.
P is not a free variable, right? The capital P is a sum of the P's at a vertex, isn't it?
Well, a little P is that, right? That's what I mean.
Yeah, the big P's are not.
Well, I just don't understand once you've exponentiated why I can't just look at things in terms of the z's and the x's and all that stuff.
You could do the integrals in a different order. It's just that z is only appearing multiplying capital P, whereas the p's appear all over the action.
Okay, fine, but I'll get delta of z with other stuff. I just cut off the other stuff to simplify the idea I'm expressing. I agree with you.
Okay, so
that's what will happen. But I don't understand why the P's are more fundamental than the other things, given you've got this linearity. That's what I'm not getting.
But this is quadratic in P, right? So well,
for the C's, okay, sure, okay, it is. For the X's and the others. So, but still, I mean, I can integrate a quadratic thing.
Yeah, and you can complicate it.
But so what? Why does that matter?
Well, but you agree also that you can live in the world that I like, which is where there's nothing integrated over, and we just have some deltas of p's.
Yeah, but it's not a unique possibility.
It doesn't have to be. I never claimed it was a unique possibility.
I thought you said that at the beginning you like only one theory.
So. Yes, but the theory doesn't like me.
I feel they're going on the wrong direction. Okay, so other questions, comments for Lee? Yes.
Is there a notion of when you go to low energies that you can see here how the number of equation changes so that it's more plausible that you have money?
Or that it's implausible.
Or that it's implausible.
Yeah. But for me, the fact that it's contingent, it's very easy to write down systems that don't close. So there's no way you can integrate out the p's and have x's left. They're all in this package of different kinds of systems.
Yeah, I agree. I was just wondering if there's a way to see it just on this slide.
Probably there is.
And you want to figure it out. Good. Other questions? Alice?
Oh, sorry. So this might be a really dumb question, but you mentioned that you could, going from Z to ZK to ZL, you can draw a Minkowski space-time realm.
I can always draw a piece of Minkowski spacetime.
Right.
But I can't necessarily draw exactly the right pieces that I can glue together. And they'll let me go on and build the. It's like one of these tessellation problems. Sometimes you can fit them together, and sometimes you can't.
So would curvature arise from how you tessellate the different pieces of Minkowski's piece?
Ah, yes. That's what I'd love to do. By the way, I'd love to have help if you want to work. That's hard, but I'd love.
There's a question online, I think.
Yes. Yeah, thanks, Nash. Lee, it's Andrew Richards here. I'm just wondering on your theory, fundamentally, does it suggest, or is this where you're coming from, that the fundamental element of the universe is energy? What we observe is just reconfigurations of that energy. So it's a two-part question, but that's the first part.
Okay. I have no. I'm not. Again, my job is to make the bloody thing work. It's not to interpret.
Well, but that when you started out, that's what I heard. I think I heard you say. That's why I'm asking
the
question.
No, you could, but you know, this thing happened to me when I wrote The Life of the Cosmos. Is people overinterpret and they want to talk about their interpretation of it. Is the universe alive and things like that? And I didn't want to talk about that. So I don't want to talk about whether this points to a universe full of energy.
Okay, the second part. It comes about yesterday, or the I think Robert Mann was talking, and I wanted to ask him the question that I've heard him correctly. I think, Robert, yesterday you said nothing is nothing. So my second part of the question to you, Lee, would be, does your model consider the existence of nothing?
Boy, I don't have to answer that question. I really don't.
You don't have to. No, you're quite right.
No, I'm not. Some people have been kind enough to call me a philosopher. But I'm really not a philosopher. You know, if I can get through the last wormhole back into the last universe before and say something decent about that, I'll be happy.
Very
good.
Okay, so we have to. Thank you.
A student question, and Steve is going to have an hour to say about this. But yes, I have. You go ahead. Then maybe you already said this, and I missed it. But this was supposed to describe 11-dimensional M theory, right?
Originally, this.
Can you also write this in any like four-dimension target and it still works at the quantum level?
The program to get a hidden variable theory works, as far as I can tell, in any dimension. The facts about it that they were interested in as M theorists were those that they could make connections to M theory, and therefore for them, the points, which they called D0 brains, had nice properties that were useful for that you had to use the supersymmetry and so forth. And I'm not against doing that. I just thought that since I had written a paper about this model and Robert brought it up, it would be interesting to talk about it. What I would love to hear is one of the philosophers say, you've to this week shown us one model which has two completely different interpretations. Is that possible? Then we'll get nervous.
Okay, so I think we should probably move on. But I don't know if there's any very pointed questions. So let's thank Lee again.
Thank you. Thank you.